This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we discuss the case of Bernina Mata. Our guests provide insight on her real story and her current road to clemency. We speak with one of the nation's leading experts on reentry after release from prison.
Joanne Page, she's the head of the Fortune Society. We should have a Fortune Society in every city in the country.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
In 1998, Bernina Mata was convicted of first-degree murder in the killing of John Dreheim, who she'd met at a local bar. After he tried to rape her, she fought back in defense and stabbed him. At trial, prosecutors portrayed Mata as a man-hating lesbian. They described her as a, quote, hardcore lesbian who they claimed killed because the victim made an unwanted sexual pass at her. They alleged that Mata's sexuality was the motive and showed the jury books from her apartment, including Call Me Lesbian, Homosexualities, and Best Lesbian Reading, to support their theory. Prosecutors claimed that, quote, a normal heterosexual person would not be so offended by the victim's conduct as to murder. The jury found Mata guilty and sentenced her to death. In 2003, her sentence was commuted from death to life in prison, after former Governor George Ryan commuted the sentences of everyone on that state's death row in response to a historic organizing clemency campaign. Now, Mata's defense team are asking Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker to grant her release from prison. They filed a petition for executive clemency, saying that her case was plagued by racism and anti-lesbian oppression. Joining us to talk about Bernina Mata's case are attorney Joey Mogul and Dina Lewis. Joey is partner at the People's Law Office and has represented Mata since 2002. Dina is an associate director at the Institute for Research on Race and Public Policy at the University of Illinois in Chicago. Dina is also involved in the work of several Chicago community and national organizing collectives, including Love and Protect, Just Practice Collaborative, and Survived and Punished. Joey and Dina, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having us, Heidi. This is Joey Mogul.
So excited to be here. This is Dina.
Hi, Dina. Let's start with Joey. How did the prosecution's case theory improperly influence jurors in Bernina's trial?
Well, unfortunately, their racism and their homophobia infected the entire criminal investigation and prosecution in this case. From the start, you know, Bernina is a Latina woman and a lesbian. And prior to the murder and her incarceration, Bernina's life was defined by extreme sexual, physical, and emotional abuse at the hands of her family members and years of being abandoned and neglected by families, schools, and others in her life. And this included being violently raped by her stepfather at age 4, requiring she receive hospitalization to repair her injuries. Over the course of her life, she was in and out of foster care, although every time she was returned home, she continued to experience abuse. And eventually, she was institutionalized in a mental hospital for 2 years after suffering significant psychological trauma. All of this history was completely disregarded and distorted throughout the investigation and then the prosecution. Now, with respect to the murder itself of John Dreheim, there was ample evidence that Bernina believed that she was acting in self-defense, and that John Dreheim, the victim, was attempting to rape her. According to Bernina, she had met John Dreheim for the very first time hours earlier that very same evening at a bar where she and John and others were drinking. And they returned to her home, where they were drinking with several others at their home and partying that night. And at one point, she left the living room, and she then went to her bedroom. And when she got there, she found John Draham naked, wearing a condom. And he grabbed her, and he demanded sex from her. They then struggled, and she attempted to defend herself. And this was considerable in that Draham was demonstrably bigger and weighed more than her. He was 5'10 and 220 pounds. Bernina was a mere 5'3 and 135 pounds. And at one point, she remembers during the struggle, Draham biting her forearm. And at that time, that triggered her, and she suffered a flashback of her remembering her stepfather raping her. And that's when she then grabbed a butterfly knife out of her back pocket, and she stabbed him. Now, there was substantial evidence that she was acting in self-defense, or that she reasonably believed she was acting in self-defense, and that she was, you know, suffering extreme emotional distress at the time that this murder was committed. And this was exacerbated by her long history of sexual abuse. And there were also evidence of documented wounds showing that there was this struggle, and her body was evidence of that. And again, all of this evidence regarding the extenuating and what I would argue mitigating circumstances as to what led to the tragic loss of John Draham's life, it was distorted throughout the investigation and the prosecution. And instead, the state chose to seize on Bernina's lesbian identity to depict her as a, quote, hardcore lesbian, unquote, and to argue then that as a hardcore lesbian, she hated men, was prone to commit violence against them, and that this was the premeditation and motive for why she killed Draham. And the state did this deliberately. They portrayed her this way to not only secure her murder conviction, but to get her a death sentence. Because in order to get the death sentence, they needed to establish there was an aggravating circumstance or factor as to why she warranted to be executed. And the only aggravating factor that they could rely on was one known at the time in Illinois law, was that she acted in a cold, calculated, premeditated manner pursuant to a conceived plan. Now, again, the evidence that existed belied such circumstances. She'd only met Draham for the very first time at a bar earlier that day. Everyone had been drinking and was severely intoxicated. And again, there was extreme mitigating circumstances regarding Bernina's life and history with sexual abuse. So in order to get the jury to ignore that substantial evidence, they had to argue she acted in this premeditated manner. And they did that by using her sexual identity, which was wholly irrelevant to this crime altogether. And the fact is, the state used her sexual identity, and they discriminated against her based on her sexual orientation, and that infected the entire criminal proceedings. The state proceeded to parade 10 witnesses before the jury to testify she was a lesbian. As you discussed, they removed 3 books from her home and just showed the titles to the jury so they would understand that she was a lesbian. Unfortunately, they weren't even provided the books so that they might learn from them. And then the state proceeded to argue about her lesbian identity 17 different times throughout their arguments to the jury. And they, in fact, had the nerve to argue that she was somehow overtly homosexual in flaunting her sexuality, proclaiming it to anyone who would listen. When in reality, the state refused to stipulate to Bernina Mata's sexual orientation, and instead, they repeatedly flaunted it before this jury in 1998, knowing that it would prejudice her before them and motivate them to convict and kill her. And that's precisely what happened in this case. And that's why she then was sentenced to die. She was on death row. Now she has her death sentence commuted, but she's doing life without the possibility of parole. And that's why we are seeking that her sentence be commuted so that she can be released. And then without Governor Pritzker giving her a commutation, she will now die in prison. And so the state's use of her lesbian identity was actually calculated and preconceived to essentially ignore the extenuating and mitigating circumstances as to what led to this murder and to demonize her before this jury. And one last thing I want to add is, while there was substantial evidence of mitigating circumstances and Bernina Mata's reasonable belief that she was acting in self-defense. Draheim, the victim's history of violence against women, was completely kept out of the trial. So the jury was never informed of the fact that prior to his murder, over a seven-year period, he had committed repeated acts of violence against his ex-wife and children, leading his ex-wife to call the police on multiple occasions, secure an order of protection against him, and ultimately divorce him. And again, all of this evidence corroborated Bernita's truth regarding how she believed she was defending herself from an attempted rape by John Draheim. In this case, it's really clear to me that both Bernina's race as a Latina and her sexual orientation completely infected how the case was investigated, how it was prosecuted, and ultimately why she was given a death sentence.
Joey, thank you for that excellent overview. I want to clarify for our listeners, you've used the term aggravating and mitigating circumstances. And in fact, in capital cases, jurors, when they sentence, must balance both. It's really a legal term of art. Certain things qualify as mitigators, and one would certainly be Bernina's history of being abused from the age of four on, versus aggravators. So it seems that the process wasn't adhered to in this case.
Well, in this case, I mean, I would agree that, yes, there are these aggravating and mitigating circumstances, and not every murder becomes a death-eligible case. They needed the aggravating factor in order to make it a death-eligible case. But again, the circumstances belie that this was some preconceived, cold, calculated plan to kill him. I mean, generally, that's the type of aggravating factor you would think when there's a contract killing, right? But here, you know, meeting someone at a bar hours earlier, that really doesn't qualify as this type of aggravating factor. But again, this is why they seized on her lesbian sexual identity to use what we would call these archetypes of, like, the man-hating lesbian who thirsts to kill men. And because the assumption is that, you know, it's only normal to want to be with someone of the so-called opposite sex. And here, you know, here, if she was someone who wanted to be with other women, that therefore made her abnormal, and that made her sick and deviant and therefore prone to violence. And that's the way they tapped into this, what we would call man-hating, homicidal lesbian archetype, in order to really distract the jury, distract them from the real evidence in this case, and motivate them to kill her. That's exactly why, when they were arguing that her lesbian identity was somehow relevant to this case, they literally argued to the court that a, quote, normal heterosexual woman, unquote, would not be offended by such conduct as to murder. And again, the state's theory here was that John Draheim made an unwanted sexual pass at her, and this just so inflamed her as a, quote, hardcore lesbian, unquote, that that's why she killed him. And it's just absurd to argue. I mean, it's not only just absurd, it's morally unconscionable, it's indefensible to argue that someone's sexual identity motivated to kill. Again, this happens so much in our legal cases, and this is why our whole legal system is just profoundly inadequate and unfair and unjust. But technically, there was, you know, they made the arguments around aggravating and mitigating circumstances, but as we see in far too many cases, racism, homophobia, and sexism win the day. They persuade jurors and judges to just absolutely tap into these oppressive notions, beliefs, and prejudices, as opposed to really looking at the facts of the case, in this case, her extenuating, mitigating circumstances.
Dina, you're backing Bernina's bid for clemency. Tell us how you got involved in this case, and also, what is Love and Protect?
Sure. So first, let me explain what or who Love and Protect is. We are a small grassroots volunteer collective in Chicago, and we support criminalized survivors who have been jailed for self-defense. And so criminalized survivors, the criminalized survivors that we support, so mainly people of color, typically transgender and cisgender women, non-binary or gender-expansive folks, and trans men, who have defended themselves against intimate partner violence and or sexual assault and have been punished by the state via some sort of incarceration. So that's how we're defining criminalized survivors. So Love and Protect provides material and emotional support for criminalized survivors. We do letter writing. We put money on people's commissary accounts. We write support letters for clemency. We host different types of support events. We'll do also court support. And we also try to do a lot of political education around violence in general, but also criminalized survivors and the different defense campaigns. So we got involved because Joey, a longtime supporter of Love and Protect and an amazing attorney in person, contacted us to say, hey, this is a person we would love, we being Bernita's defense team, we would love for Love and Protect to support. So that's really how we started supporting Bernina and got involved in the case in trying to help get Bernina free.
I understand Bernina is now 51 years old and has been incarcerated for nearly half of her life, 23 years. How are her conditions of confinement and also her state of mind at this point?
Well, I want to again emphasize, like, there's an amazing Free Bernina defense team that consists of Love and Protect and Dina Lewis, among others. In the process of arguing for commutation, Love and Protect and the Free Bernina defense team have created this community of care, this beloved community of supporters. And so Bernina obviously is serving life in prison. It's very difficult. She's done everything in her power to access as many educational and so-called rehabilitative programs she can. The problem is that doing life in prison means that she can't, in fact, access whatever limited rehabilitative programs there are, because the institution doesn't think it's worthwhile for her to take these programs, since she'll never be getting out. This is another reason why we really are asking that her sentence be commuted. But for the most part, I would say Bernina's done everything in her power to be positive, be productive. She works. She's gotten her GED. She's taken college classes. She's become certified to be an attendant for Americans with Disabilities. She's worked with different programs training dogs. She loves animals. But overall, I would say that Bernina feels very positive and very hopeful and very grateful for this new community of beloved support that has been created, particularly in her case, like so many others of queer and trans people, where she has suffered extreme oppressive and discriminatory circumstances and essentially been exiled from her biological family. And that's often who shows up for people who are incarcerated. She now has this beloved community of care organized by the Free Bernina defense team. And so I think Bernina's doing, you know, as best as she can, given the circumstances.
What's the history of governors granting clemency petitions in the state of Illinois?
Well, I'll jump in and say, generally, Governor Pritzker has granted more clemencies than other preceding governors. I would say that's not saying much, because most of our other governors were not good at granting clemencies. But, you know, Love and Protect in particular has had amazing success in educating the public, as well as I would say the governor and the Illinois Prisoner Review Board, around the circumstances of criminalized survivors and how those circumstances are not truly dealt with in the criminal legal system. So, Dina, I want to kick it to you to add your thoughts on this.
Sure. And, you know, I also want to point out that we're not doing this work individually, and that it's really important to do this type of liberation work with other people and other organizations. So I also want to bring in other people from the defense, Bernina's defense campaign, like Rachel White Domain, who Love and Protect works with and has worked with around other clemency cases, most notably Takunzi Green, and also our other partners like Moms United Against Violence and Incarceration, Women's Justice Institute. So there are a lot of people who are trying to do the work of freeing folks who have experienced intimate partner violence and then state violence. And what we really try to do with clemency campaigns is to figure out clearly a good strategy and then start getting the packages together, getting the packets together, and doing that hard work and getting public support and other types of support. So I'm not really sure about political affiliation of governors and their granting of clemency petitions. I really think it depends on what's happening in that time. So what's happening in that political moment, also how the governor is feeling at that moment too.
Dina, could you talk briefly about how histories of abuse make women especially vulnerable to incarceration?
Yeah, and I want to reference here the work of Dr. Beth Ritchie, Insight, which is a network of radical feminists of color who organized to end state violence and violence in our homes and communities, Survived and Punished, and other folks who have been pointing out that the state doesn't protect people of color, and certainly not transgender and cisgender women of color, certainly not gender non-binary folks or trans men. So that calling on the state to support them while they are in or trying to leave an abusive relationship opens up that person to more state violence. So that when people are deciding to leave relationships, which is already really hard and actually a choiceless situation, they're made more vulnerable to violence by the state. I also want to make sure that in this moment I mention our comrade and friend Monica Cosby, who has really been thinking about the well-known power and control wheel used in domestic violence agencies and the connections to prison violence. And so she talks about how the violence in and of prisons mirrors that same violence at home. And you can map intimate partner violence onto prison and state violence, so that control, coercion, power in intimate partner violence feels or is state violence, feels or is prison violence, feels or is intimate partner violence, right? So we're talking about the same patterns that happen at home are happening in prison. So these patterns of power, control, coercion that exist in intimate partner violence ends up making people more vulnerable, specifically women, more vulnerable to incarceration as they're trying to leave or as they're trying to access help and not getting the support from the social systems that they need to reduce the harm in their lives.
Dina, is that the so-called abuse to prison pipeline, or is that something different?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of research that shows that when people experience repeated violence, whether it's individuals, so this type of abuse, or institutional, so coming from schools, meaning the school-to-prison pipeline or school-prison nexus, that they end up being more vulnerable to state violence, such as prison. And this sexual abuse-to-prison pipeline, this concept was first, I would say, published in 2015, a report by the Center on Poverty and Inequality at Georgetown Law. And in that study, they found overwhelmingly, and we also know this too, that the overwhelming number of girls and women in jails and prisons have experienced some sort of sexual abuse in their past before being incarcerated. We're talking like over 90%. And that experience of violence put them into contact with the criminal legal system. So, for instance, young people, girls under 18, can be arrested for trying to run away from home, so run away from the violence, or are not attending school for a variety of reasons, including trauma from the violence. So people can be arrested for those status offenses. And then also, as people are trying to leave, they can also come into contact with other state agencies like Child Protective Services and foster care that then put them on a different type of radar and a different type of surveillance so that the person who is being harmed has to constantly be perfect, right, in order to stay outside of prison. And so it's difficult for folks to get the support and help they need and be just a human when they're trying to get away from violence.
You know, I think all that Dina's discussing is really important, but I want to say this in particular, this is all racially motivated as well. I mean, it's the women of color, it's the queer and trans people of color that we see abandoned, abused, and suffering cycles of violence and oppression. Then when it leads to the criminalization, and that can be in foster care, that can be in school, that can be in different, you know, CPS, et cetera. And then eventually when they get to the criminal legal system, we don't see any sympathy. We don't see any understanding and support. And instead, we see the state seizing on people's racial, gender identities and sexual orientations to demonize them and use it as so-called aggravating evidence as opposed to mitigating evidence. And that's what I think is fueling this abuse to prison pipeline.
That's so interesting. Thank you, Joey. I'm curious, at trial, is there a standard manner in which histories of trauma are brought forth?
Well, sure. You can get forensic psychologists or psychiatrists who can then do interviews of individuals to argue that they didn't have the state of mind to commit the murder or that there were extenuating circumstances. But again, this is where I think the criminal legal system completely fails us. Because what will happen is that, for example, in Bernina Mata's case, the defense did have a forensic psychologist who interviewed Bernina and said at the time that she was suffering PTSD and experiencing trauma and setbacks and that flashbacks, and that's why she wasn't acting rationally at the time that the murder was committed. But the state then goes and gets their own forensic psychologist who then decides to distort and demonize Bernina, even though cannot ignore her history, her documented, conceded history, extensive history of sexual abuse and violence. And again, this is what I see is that the criminal legal system isn't about let's try to understand what happened, let's try to figure out how we can deal with the structural racism and inequalities in our systems in the U.S., but instead it becomes a game about winning. And one expert versus another expert to then try to portray to the jury who's right, who's wrong, who should win, who should lose, with very severe, dire consequences here. We should be looking at Bernina's case and say, how did it get to this point? Why was Bernina treated to such racism and sexual violence and homophobia throughout her entire life? What can we do differently as a community, as a country, to try to ensure this doesn't happen to anyone? And instead, we boil it down to one decision, one choice, made in the heat of the moment under extenuating, extreme emotional disturbance, and say, you're at fault, Bernina, and you should then be punished, and in this case, die. You know, so again, I would say this is why there are so many people who are moving towards abolition, because they understand that the criminal legal system is not designed to really try to get at the roots and deal with the systemic violence in our country and try to really deter violent acts in the future. And I think this is what the tremendous work Love and Protect and Survived and Punish are doing, and why people are saying the criminal legal system doesn't work and we need to abolish it and look for alternatives.
I also thank you for that, Joey. I also want to jump in and say that so we're not trauma-centered. We don't know a lot about intimate partner violence, and we meaning just the general public. And we learn mostly through these complete, you know, fantastical TV shows like, you know, Law and Order and all of these others. So when people are in the courtroom, they're expecting a certain type of what they would call victim, we would call survivor, and that person does not look like Bernina Mata. And that's a problem because Bernina is a survivor. And exactly as Joey said, Bernina did what she needed to do to survive, and she should not have had to suffer all of that violence her entire life. And so it's not only the legal system that needs to change, it's overall society. We need to understand violence better, what it looks like. We need to understand what trauma looks like and how it comes up, and we need to work harder to keep all of our communities safe.
how can our listeners learn more about Bernina Mata's case, maybe get involved, join the important work that both of you are doing?
Well, I'll start off by saying we have an amazing defense team. As Dina said, we have friends from American Friends Service Committee, the Illinois Prison Project, amongst others. There's a free Bernina website. Please check it out, free Bernina, BERNINA.com. Sign up. We have a newsletter. Please sign up to write Governor Pritzker and demand that he grant Bernina clemency. In the fall, we're going to have educational materials coming out. You can hold a teach-in. There will be other ways to get involved. So please check out the freebernina.com website. Dina, what should people folks do for Love and Protect?
Sure. You can find us at loveprotect.org, also on social media, mainly Facebook, although we do have an Instagram account and Twitter. And we are doing different events throughout the summer and the year to support not only Bernina, but other criminalized survivors that we're connected with who are still inside and that we're trying to get free.
Joey and Dina, you are both doing incredibly important work. You are heroes to all of us here at Law and Disorder, and we'd love to stay in touch with you about Bernina's case. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Here in the United States, more than 600,000 individuals are released from state and federal prisons. A staggering 6.9 million are on probation, in jail, in prison, or on parole. And on top of that, an additional 9 million people cycle through local jails. As grim as these statistics are, more sobering is the fact that more than two-thirds of prisoners are rearrested within 3 years of their release. Half of those are reincarcerated. Why is this recidivism rate so high? It has much to do with the failure of reentry support programs. The U.S. has the world's largest carceral state, but no effective support system for persons finishing their sentences and reentering society. Consequently, crime rates soar, more individuals are victims of crime, families and communities suffer when we fail to deal with the consequences of over-incarceration. When reentry fails, the costs are high. More crime, more victims, and more pressure on an already strained budget system, both state and municipal. There's also more family distress and community instability. Community reintegration impacts several larger areas, such as community health, education, employment, family relationships, and housing. In every aspect, failure to support recently released individuals is costly to society. Joining us today is one of the nation's preeminent leaders in reintegration. Joanne Page is the president and CEO of the New York-based Fortune Society. Policymakers and researchers frequently cite the organization for its pioneering work. A graduate of Yale Law School, Joanne Page cultivated and created many of Fortune's signature programs, including substance abuse treatment, counseling, family services, HIV/AIDS health services, mental health programs, parenting initiatives, jobs training, and more. Joanne Page is a leading authority on issues including prison reform, solitary confinement, wrongful convictions, the over-incarceration of young men of color, violence prevention, legislation, and many more. Joanne Page, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It is such a pleasure to be on your show. Thank you so much.
Joanne, when someone in New York State walks out of prison, often after many years, if they don't have family or friends or even a place to stay, what are they given in terms of money, assistance?
I'm glad you're asking that question, because the worst thing they're given, they are put in a shelter if they're homeless. So half the people coming out of New York State prison are put into New York City shelters if they're being released to New York City. And that is an awful way to start, especially for people who are older and really institutionalized and will have a tough transition, even under the best of circumstances. To land in one of New York City's large barrack-style shelters, which are often rife with violence and drug use, is just, it's like running a gauntlet.
You volunteered at the Fortune Society for years before becoming its executive director. Before that, you attended law school. You volunteered in prisons. How have prison reentry landscape changed from your early years till now?
You know, the prison reentry landscape has changed dramatically. I started doing volunteer work in the 1970s, just as the country was closing down its mental health capacity. And what I saw was people being transferred to prison who had been in the mental health system. And what we've seen since I started as a volunteer is a dramatic increase in the number of mentally ill people who are in prison. Right now, the jails and the prisons are the largest mental health, you can't call them treatment, but the largest mental health facilities in the country. And the other thing that I witnessed was the ballooning of the jail and prison population due to the so-called war on drugs. I worked at Legal Aid as a criminal defense lawyer starting in 1980, and I didn't even bother to memorize the codes for drug cases, because there were so few. And then with our so-called war on drugs, which was really a war on poor people of color with drug addiction issues, the prisons and the jails just ballooned. So that what we had was something like 22,000 people locked up in New York State at the height of incarceration in New York, which was 1991. And the positive thing we've seen is that we really have been bringing down the number of people who are locked up. So it was 22,000 people in New York City jails in 1991. The absolute lowest point was in April, right after the pandemic hit, when they started releasing people, and we had 3,800 people. So from 22,000 to 3,800, which was the lowest since the 1940s, partly due to bail reform, partly due to release through the pandemic. But what troubles me is we're starting to see an upward tick in people being locked up again, especially around pretrial detainees.
Before we get into the services that Fortune Society offers, I want to clarify, is it the Department of Correction, the State Division of Parole, and New York's Health and Human Services that ostensibly offer help for newly released persons?
I wouldn't say maybe any of those do. So the Department of Correction pretty much ends it once the person gets out. Then you have people who come out of state prison who can be placed on parole. They are supposed to be helping with people's reentry. There is no government entity that helps when people come out of the city jails. Essentially, what you have is a cobbled together group of nonprofits, Fortune among them, who barely scratch the surface of the needs. So when people come out of state prison, they're on parole by and large. But half of them who are being released to New York City, half of the parolees being released to New York City, are dumped in the city shelters because they're homeless. With people who come out of jail, there's pretty much nothing except this network of nonprofit providers. And we are struggling beyond belief right now in terms of budget cuts, late contracts, uncertainty about funding. So there is no safety net. There really is no safety net. I think what there is a shredded, hole full net where most people fall through, and fall through hard and badly.
What kind of programs does the Fortune Society offer?
So we do a whole range. We call ourselves one-stop shopping because what we offer to anybody who walks in our doors is help in identifying their needs, crisis intervention like food and clothing, and connecting them to the services that they need. And over the years, I've been at Fortune, believe it or not, 31 years. We've really expanded the range of services we offer. Our probably deepest intervention and our most limited resource is our housing, and we house about 400 people a year right now who were homeless and formerly incarcerated. But the need is so much greater. We see about 9,000 people a year, and 20-25% of them are homeless. So we see the transformation that housing offers, but unfortunately, we're able to offer it only to a small percentage of the people who need it. We also have other pivotal services. We do discharge planning from the jails. We work with people once they're in the community. We have licensed drug treatment and licensed mental health services. We have a whole employment array to help people get and hold jobs, get training, do stipended work when they're learning how to hold a job. So there are a whole array of services, but the need is so much greater. And, you know, more than half our staff are formerly incarcerated, which means that we are often where people come because somebody they know and trust has put their life together as a result of our services. The challenge is how to meet an enormous need with limited resources. We're also an advocacy organization because we don't just want to help people heal from the ordeal of incarceration or avoid alternatives. We also run alternative to incarceration programs. But what we want to do is try to change the policies that chew people up. So we're doing some work right now on the prison to shelter pipeline, because we think it's appalling that half the people coming out of state prison are landing in the shelters. We've done major work and are doing major work around housing discrimination based on record and job discrimination based on record. Because when people come home, they come home with an albatross around their necks. They get punished for the rest of their lives for that experience of being arrested and convicted and incarcerated. And in fact, the Brennan Center just did a recent study showing that people lose half their earning capacity if they've been incarcerated. That people who already were kind of on the bottom of the totem pole because of race and class in terms of earning have an earning capacity half that of similarly situated people who didn't go to prison. So those are core advocacy issues for us.
Tell us, please, about the Fortune Academy. It began as an abandoned drug den. What is it now?
Oh, it's a magical place. What we ended up doing was buying an abandoned building in West Harlem that had crack vials underfoot and that had major drug dealing in the backyard. And we turned it into a residence for people who are formerly incarcerated or homeless, to let them land, build their skills for living in the current non-incarcerated world, and build a community of support, and then move out into the community. And we've been open since 2002. We probably serve about 100 people a year. And the joy for me is watching people transform, just watching people blossom when they're in a safe place. We did something I'm very proud of, and that is during the pandemic, we had to close intake at the Fortune Academy because we have so many people who are seniors and were medically vulnerable. But we opened a new building to house 38 people. And at the time that New York City and New York State were releasing medically vulnerable people, they wouldn't release those who didn't have an address. They wouldn't release those who were homeless. And we were able to create the beds to get 38 such people out of harm's way. So our housing is a pivotal part of what we do. And what you see in the Fortune Academy is what happens with people when they see hope and have a safe place to lay their head and have supportive services. We are seen as a model throughout the country. We replicated our housing in Syracuse, and we are talking to folks in Pennsylvania and Washington, D.C., and other places in the country about replicating that model. I would invite you to come visit, but because of COVID, we are doing our meetings in Zoom now.
Well, I'll take you up on your invitation, although I have to say I've been there and was extremely encouraged by what you folks are doing. Can you share a couple of stories about people who've done especially well from receiving your services?
Well, I'd like to share one story especially, and you mentioned David Rothenberg. He does his radio show on Saturday mornings on WBAI, and he interviewed one of our past residents, a woman named Becky, who got released from Rikers Island in her pajamas. And, I mean, with nothing, in her pajamas. And we were able to meet her, get her anchored at the castle, get her the clothing that she needed, help her build the confidence and the skills and the legitimate income source that let her move on. And she's currently living independently in the community. We have board members right now who came through the castle, came out of incarceration after decades of incarceration, and are now in the human services field making a difference to others, and on our board helping us continue our services. So the joy of this work is you can take people who are in crisis, who are coming out of really violent, dehumanizing experiences, and create an environment where people can put down roots and thrive, and then reach back and help the other people coming behind them, which is a core part of our model, both for our staff and our clients, that the payback for the services, which we will not charge you for, is to reach back and help the next person coming down the pike.
Joanne, if you were running the nation's penal system, and we wish you were, what would you change?
The first thing I would do is shrink it dramatically. We lock up too many people. And no matter how humane a prison system is, locking people up does damage. So the first, and I think Jerry Miller in Massachusetts is my role model on that. What he did was he closed down the juvenile institutions, limited the number of beds, and looked for alternatives for how to work with kids who are in trouble. So the first thing would be to bring the population down dramatically. We've got seniors who've served decades who are no risk to anybody. We've got people with nonviolent convictions. We've got people who turned their lives around. We've got people who, if they were not people of color, never would have been locked up in the first place. I mean, when we did three strikes in California, we locked up more people on marijuana than on murder, rape, and robbery combined. So first would be bring down the population so that you're keeping only people who would pose a risk to the community if they were not incarcerated. And then the second thing is we have no excuse for having the kind of vicious institutions that we have. People should be physically safe. They're not. People should be in an environment where they're treat somebody who you expect to see return to the community as a citizen, as somebody who matters. We should be treating people in a way that builds them, not that tears them down. So it would be two things. One is trim down the population dramatically, and the other is create institutions that are about healing and redemption. The punishment is being locked up. There is no reason that people should be under continual punishment once that punishment has been inflicted. And if you think of it in thirds, right, fewer people locked up, humane institutions for the very small minority who need to be locked up, and then removing the barriers to full participation in the community once people are released. I think what happened in Florida is both hope and a travesty. The hope is that people had a lifetime ban against ability to vote if they were people with records. And the Florida voting population voted to lift that. And then the Florida legislature imposed the effect of a poll tax and kept those people from voting by saying that if they had any outstanding fines, they wouldn't be allowed to vote. So 3 points, right? Far fewer people locked up. Institutions that would do us proud as rehabilitative institutions, and removing the barriers to living a life in the community for people who've been released.
We're speaking with Joanne Page from the Fortune Society. Joanne, I want to ask you, why do we treat prisoners with so little regard for human life and dignity? And particularly, I wanted to ask you about the COVID pandemic. I've got a friend, David Gilbert, who's locked up in the Catskills of the Shawangunk Correctional Facility, and I speak with him on the phone frequently, and he tells me that they won't even let him go to the mess hall with a plate, get food, and come back to his cell. So he's got to sit next to people. The guards bring in the pandemic. Other prisoners who they sit cheek to jowl have it, and there's really no effort to protect these people, much less let them out. Why do you think that's true?
You know, I think what COVID did was just make vividly clear the inequities in our society, right? In terms of rates of death, in terms of who's at most risk, in terms of showing the problems in the medical system. And the criminal justice system is the belly of the beast. It's where our greatest inequities show up. So I was listening to the governor's State of the Union. He never mentioned prison populations as a population for vaccination. Right now, people in jails in New York City have almost 6 times the rate of COVID infection as New Yorkers in general. Right. What you're talking about in both the jails and the prisons is that people are confined right up against each other. They can't wash their hands. There are people who are not wearing masks. And heaven help you if you get sick. We've gotten letters from people who talk about being put in solitary confinement because they had COVID and getting very little medical care, sometimes not even getting adequate food. But basically being locked up and let's see what happens. Do you live or do you die? So what's happening right now about COVID is really obscene. It's really obscene. We and our colleagues are pushing hard to make sure that people who are locked up are a priority population to get vaccinated. But to put people in a situation where they have no recourse, where they can't escape, where they're at risk of infection, where if they get sick, they get terribly inadequate medical care, is an affront to civilized society. It's awful. It's really awful.
Do you see any hope for change with the incoming Biden administration?
You know, I'm so hopeful. One of the things that we see at Fortune is what we call system babies, and that's people who got raised by the system and did not have a loving family. And those children who were separated from their parents, who are scattered all over the country, who will never find their way back because there was no effort to be able to find them and reunite them again, that will not happen again. What we're also seeing is the private jails full of immigrants. Our hope is that that will change. We are seeing an escalation of the death penalty. We're seeing person after person executed after a hiatus of years. I don't think that will continue. President Obama was going to end contracting with private prisons. I hope that will happen. But also, what we need is work on racial equity issues, and the center of the target, in my mind, needs to be what happens in the criminal justice system. If you sit in court and you watch people flowing through that system, you rarely will see a white person. A racial skewing of our criminal justice system is so visible. My hope is that the promises that Biden has made, President Biden soon enough, President Biden has made, is that he is really going to address racial inequity. And I think the first place needs to be our criminal justice system, or rather, as people are saying now, our criminal legal system, because we need more justice in it.
Joanne Page, how can our listeners follow your work and learn more about the Fortune Society?
There are two ways to reach us. One is just through our website, which is fortunesociety.org, and the other is to call us, and that's 212. do it at 347-510-3601. And we want to be reached both by people who can help us in our work, either as volunteers or as donors or as people who can share coats, food. And we also want to be there for people who need our services, either for themselves or their loved ones. You know, I'm a kid of Holocaust survivors. And to be able to do work that reflects my values with the kind of people who are the Fortune community both feeds my soul and makes me feel that I am making a difference in ways that really matter to me. So I feel incredibly lucky to have been able to do decades of this work.
Joanne Page, it's been beautiful talking with you. Thank you very much. Thank you for your good work, and we hope to have you on again in the future. Every success to you, Joanne.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for a wonderful interview. It's been a pleasure talking to both of you, and I'd invite you to come visit once it's possible to make that kind of invitation.
We'll be turning up at your doorstep.
Yeah, I love it. Thank you so much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.